Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the silky smooth sounds of the Green and Red podcast. I am your co-host, Scott Parkin, and I wanted to share this video. We had a live event last week in Berkeley, California. It was called Radicals, Realists, and Repression, the State of Activism in the U.S. And it was a conversation about the state of the movement in the United States. And we're in the midst of seeing a serious rollback of First Amendment protected activities. States are passing anti-protest legislation. Police are increasingly militarized. ICE is even worse. It's a paramilitary Gestapo of sorts. But we're also seeing large-scale resistance, everything from more tame No Kings rallies to May Day mobilization to lots of direct action to lots of fierce resistance to ICE in places like Los Angeles, Chicago, and Minneapolis. And so folks here at the Green and Red podcast, plus many of our friends in the community in the Bay Area, decided to get this panel together. And so it was a pretty lively discussion. It was very interesting. We've gotten a lot of great feedback about it. A panel included Thomas Zaitzoff, who is a professor in the School of Public Affairs at American University in Washington, D.C., whose focus is on political violence and social media and political psychology. He was a recent guest on the Green and Red podcast. He's been on a couple of times, but his most recent book is No Option But Sabotage, The Radical Climate Movement and the Climate Crisis. And then Professor Omar Wasow, who is an assistant professor at UC Berkeley in the Department of Political Science. His research focuses on race, politics, and statistical methods. And then we were also joined by Annie Leonard, who's the former executive director of Greenpeace US. She's the creator of The Story of Stuff, and she has a new book out on the history of protest. And then the panel also included me, myself, Scott Parkin, who's the co-host of the Green Red podcast, longtime organizer and campaigner. And then it was moderated by our friend and also Green Red podcast guest, and we're a guest on his show, Jason Miles, who is the host of This Is Revolution podcast. And Jason is a fantastic moderator, so we're pretty excited to have him. But then also, this was a really powerful, great panel and great topic. And so hope everyone enjoys it. And as always, if you like us, please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Blue Sky. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit the subscribe button. If you're listening to us on an audio platform, give us a rate and review. If you really like us, go to greenredpodcast.org. Hit the support button or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. But enjoy the conversation and make trouble and misbehave, because that's the whole point of everything we do.
So thank you, Scott, for asking me to do this. And I'll be hosting this interesting discussion that I hope gets us all thinking. I'm going to read a little bit of a kind of opening to the talk. The panel is going to take some questions, and then we're going to take some audience questions. And I feel like this is one of those discussions where you guys are going to have a really lot to say. So I'm really looking forward to the really lot that you guys have to say. It feels like a lifetime ago, but it was only 8 years that the Stoneman Douglas High School shooting took the lives of 17 people and wounded 17 others. In the aftermath, students had become more accustomed to active shooter drills than my generation were to earthquake drills, and a generation before us to duck and cover bomb drills, spoke passionately and deliberately about gun violence and the prevalence of firearms in America. And then people listened. Their traumatic firsthand accounts helped spark a massive mobilization. The March for Our Lives protest demanded stricter gun laws. For many progressives, that was proof that the kids were all right. Others pointed out the students' whiteness afforded them a level of sympathy and media attention that black and brown victims of gun violence rarely receive. To their credit, many of the Parkland students attempted to use their platform to amplify black youth organizers already fighting against gun violence long before CNN cameras arrived. but ultimately very little changed. One of the most visible outcomes was that Parkland student David Hogg eventually became absorbed into Democratic Party politics. This was the Trump era, a period defined by protest and panic, where many Americans believed Trump represented an aspiring authoritarianism wrapped in white nationalism. During this period, openly reactionary and neo-fascist groups like the Proud Boys gained...
Did I say the wrong thing?
No, I was hissing about the...
Oh, okay. Yeah. You scared me.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry.
Oh, shit, I got hissed at. That's a first. Okay. Garnered national prominence, culminating in Trump's infamous debate remark telling them to stand back and stand by. Then came the uprising after the murder of George Floyd. Hundreds of thousands of Americans poured into the streets. Minneapolis burned. Nationwide property damage was estimated in the billions. Corporations issued black squares and statements about racial justice. Politicians kneeled in kente cloth. Defund the police briefly entered mainstream political discourse. And yet, where is that movement now? Outside of marginal budget adjustments and symbolic reforms, moving a decimal point on a spreadsheet, a very neoliberal solution to a structural problem, police violence did not stop. In fact, more people were killed by police in the years following the George Floyd protests, but those deaths no longer received the same sustained public attention. And we can't forget about COVID. The lockdowns, economic uncertainty, isolation, and nonstop chaos of Trump's pandemic press conferences pushed American society to a psychological breaking point. The country felt trapped, angry, scared, online, and atomized all at once. But something else happened during that moment that people rarely discuss. For a brief period, stimulus checks, unemployment extensions, just shouting at your friends, huh? That's my daughter. It's fine. As I was saying, for a brief period, stimulus checks, unemployment extensions, and remote work gave many people enough breathing room to step outside of their normal routines. Some people reconsidered their jobs. Some pursued creative projects. Some tried to monetize passions they had previously kept on the side. And activism increasingly became content. Podcasting exploded. Independent media exploded. Live stream commentary replaced traditional gatekeepers for millions of people. Politics itself became something consumed through personalities, algorithm, and audience capture. Fast forward through a weak and uninspiring Biden administration, a live stream genocide in Gaza, continued instabilities surrounding Russia and Ukraine, and now we arrive at Trump 2.0, this time with something the first administration lacked, an agenda, infrastructure, and loyalists prepared to execute it. The hollowing out of the bureaucratic state weakened many of the institutional barriers that previously slowed or constrained Trump's ambitions. The people surrounding him this time were not traditional Republicans loyal to party institutions or constitutional norms. They were loyal to Trump personally. Even figures like Elon Musk became symbolic of this shift. Tesla once represented a kind of aspirational green capitalism. Now the brand increasingly functions as iconography for a new tech-aligned authoritarian politics. Meanwhile, Democratic strongholds and sanctuary cities became political targets. Immigration raids intensified. Federal repression became more theatrical, more militarized. And unlike earlier eras of repression, this one unfolds in real time. It's live streamed, it's clipped, it's memed, and it's monetized, and it's distributed endlessly online, which raises an uncomfortable question. Are people exhausted? After years of permanent crisis, Trump, COVID, George Floyd, Gaza, economic instability, culture war fatigue, and algorithmic outrage, are people burned out? Have we reached a point where resistance itself feels absorbed into the spectacle? Because Trump is not moved by political outrage, he is not persuaded by appeals to democratic norms, whether it is immigration crackdowns, foreign policy escalation, attacks on protest movements, or the criminalization of dissent, this administration increasingly treats opposition itself as illegitimate. And in this new political environment, anti-fascism, socialism, and even basic dissent are increasingly portrayed as existential threats. So where do we go from here? Mama, don't let your babies grow up to be podcasters. Because if resistance becomes nothing more than branding, performance, or monetized identity, then apathy and authoritarianism begin feeding each other, and that is precisely the terrain where fascism thrives. So tonight, let's talk about what resistance and repression actually look like in this moment, how movements survive exhaustion, how people organize under increasing state pressure, and how democracy can be reclaimed from spectacle and cynicism. You guys ready?
Okay.
So my first question for the panel, and anybody can go whenever they want. Have protest movements in America become better at producing influencers than producing political victories?
Sure.
Have protest movements in America become better at producing influencers than producing political victories?
I'll jump in. And one, I loved your intro. And I'll say that I think some of the research suggests that, and I think you go back to the Women's March,
sure,
which was huge, or even the Black Lives Matter protests. These are some massive of the biggest social movements just by raw numbers of people in the streets. And social media helped fuel them. But on the flip side, and I think this is a question that organizers, but also academics are asking, is yes, it can get people out in the streets and for certain things, but the sustained kind of pressure that is needed, these movements, in some sense, as big as they were shallow. And I think that's a big question for activists and also people like myself who study these movements is, right, social media is this kind of double-edged sword for people in that we can get a lot of people together, but do we have enough sustained pressure to enact change? And I would say the answer is maybe not. It depends.
Scott?
Yeah, I started as an organizer 25 plus years ago, before we really had social media. And the thing that we always wanted to do was get pictures and get it in the newspaper or get our media hits or what have you, and then also send some sort of message to what the target was, right? These days, I'm not even completely sure if folks who are doing protests and actions and things totally even know what their targets are as much as just it's showing up. And I think there's an important element to that. I think community is really important. But like, and I didn't go to Minneapolis in January, February when things were really popping off there. But like a lot of my friends and comrades did. And they told me that like every time there would be any sort of action, an action of 10 people, there'd be twice as many reporters at it. And half of those would be like people just live streaming being influencers. And I kind of wrestle with that because the way I got my news about what was happening in Minneapolis is I'd wake up every morning and look at Instagram and see what was happening. I think that was important. So I think the influencing was important. I think when people try to make it more about themselves than like what the cause is or who we're fighting or the target is, I think that's where it's lost.
I'm taking in these very thoughtful comments and thinking, I think the Minneapolis example gets at something that we often miss, but let me start with a story. So my research focuses on protest in the academy. We often are looking at like people who are, how do we measure protest? We get newspaper accounts. And so we have these reported data on protests and that's how we build like data sets over decades. And in one time I was presenting about this, a student came up and said, you're really focused on protest, but you're not focused on organizing. Yeah. And it's like a limitation of the data. I don't observe. A lot of what matters is unobserved. And that's a really helpful bit of critical feedback that I think about a lot, right? And so I think in some ways we're also falling into a trap though when we say like the protests are just the big things, because I think echoing some of what you just said about Minneapolis, like part of what I took in about Minneapolis was that it reflected something that looked more or in many ways like the Montgomery bus boycott. There's like an enormous amount of organizing that was happening sub rosa, below the surface, people delivering diapers and food and helping people cover rent. And that was not in the news in part because people didn't want to be visible. And that is its own movement that really mattered. And importantly, the people who were in the street, two of them got killed, right? And that, in my reading of that moment, was very much an echo. And so I'm going to go a little bit longer here. There's a woman who's inspired to go from Detroit down to Selma And Viola Liuzzo is the first white woman killed in the civil rights movement when she's shuttling people back from Selma to the airport. Some Klan members kill her driving her car, right? So I looked at that and saw, wow, that's a kind of an echo of Rene Goode. And then I'm suddenly blanking on his name, but there's a young man who leaps to defend his mother in the same period, right before the Selma march, is shot in the stomach and killed. And that felt like an echo of Preti. And though that moment was pivotal in that, like, Jim Crow is like that, those killings were really critical to the dismantling of Jim Crow because it showed the world and all of these Americans who weren't paying much attention how brutal that regime was, right? So you get something similar, again, both in the under the surface organizing in Minneapolis and the high visibility killings in Minneapolis of tactics that look actually quite similar to civil rights movement tactics and were quite effective in the civil rights era. So I take both of your points that there's a lot that feels misplaced or misdirected or purposeless, but I also see really powerful echoes of what worked then working now.
Do you want to respond to it?
I don't love the framing of the question, with all due respect, because it sounds like, are protests better at producing political change or influencers? Oops. Are protests producing more influencers than political victories? I don't think they're actually producing either very well.
You sure about that?
There's
people's YouTube accounts that beg to differ.
But are protest movements creating those influencers, or are the influencers extracting, monopolizing, riding, sharing, supporting the protest?
It feels somewhat symbiotic, but
I don't know. I think protests do, obviously I love protests. I just wrote this whole tribute to protests. I think we should all protest. And I think in my lifetime, I've seen protests get some real victories. When a bunch of us protested against Shell Oil's drilling in the Arctic, and Shell said it was pulling out of drilling in the Arctic. And we could go through lots of these. But I think there's lots of values of the protest, providing social proof, providing visibility, providing an on-ramp for what I call the protest curious to come involved, helping us strengthen our communities, developing those stronger ties we need to get through the rough times. But I don't think we've had a lot of political victories come out of the protest movement lately. So that's a sad question.
I wasn't trying to be sad, but
I'm just taking stock of the moment.
But is there something that happens sometimes where when we can't get change, we settle for catharsis sometimes? And there's a cathartic release in these group activities. I saw it personally I was still living in California when the George Floyd protests were going on. And it did feel like for a lot of people, it was a bit of a cathartic release. I shut down a freeway or a street. We tore up a retail store and now we can go home. And there's pictures of it. And I was there. It was streamed live, so I can say I was there. Does it ever feel like you're talking about the civil rights movement in Minneapolis, and we covered Minneapolis from the George Floyd stuff on the show with journalists that were on the ground. And there's a massive difference between the organization that went into the civil rights movement, the discipline that went into that movement, not to belittle what happened in Minneapolis, because I think that should be something we try to build on, but did it fizzle out in some way, shape, or form? Was that a victorious situation in Minneapolis because ICE did retreat to some degree?
So a couple of quick thoughts, right? So I think it's not just that ICE retreats, but that is a turning point in how the administration is perceived in the country. That, like, Trump's polling has declined steadily since that moment. There's obviously more going on, the war in Iran, other things, part of what's so hard, so again, there are many kinds of protests and many different kinds of things people are trying to do. I agree with the point that, like, we want to not just try to reduce it to are people getting media or not getting media, getting a message out, not getting a message out, but that we live in a country where most people are not paying much attention to the news. And when they are paying attention to the news, they're often getting very different messages. And what happened in Minneapolis, through the actions of activists who put their lives on the line, right, in the Bayard Rustin idea of the only weapon we have is our bodies and we need to put them in the way of wheels so those wheels don't turn, right? Rene Goode is killed interfering with an ICE operation, right? Peretti is killed as an activist on the sidelines trying to help a woman, right? Like they are engaged in civil disobedience, it becomes a national conversation, right? And the video of that, importantly, the people documenting that are also doing really vital work to elevate the sacrifice of these activists so that people who are watching on the sidelines who are not paying much attention can see this firsthand account. And so I think there is a story there. So I'm sorry, one more thing. I don't want to belabor this. I don't want to take up more time. But so my dad did Freedom Summer in 1964 and registering voters in Mississippi. And we get this email a month ago, Columbus, Mississippi high school is honoring people who did work in Mississippi. And there's a high school student who's going to do a reenactment of my dad. Right. Oh, wow. So this is wild. Right. So my sister and my dad, 82, we go to Columbus, Mississippi a week and a half ago. So this is just very top of mind. And a lot of the questions that came to my dad from these young people were you worried about getting killed? And he said, I was like, I never really had much. He's white and Jewish, but was like in the black neighborhood, didn't have much interactions with white people. When he was there, never really felt like he was on the front lines. But he's being trained at the same time as Goodman, Cheney and Schwerner, who are murdered right before he gets sent to Columbus, Mississippi. And he was supposed to go to a more dangerous part of Mississippi. And they said, no, we're pulling back. Right. All to say, this has been top of mind for me for the last couple of weeks. And Freddie doesn't know he's going to get murdered.
Yeah.
Renee Good does not know she's going to get murdered. They do not go out thinking I'm going to die today, right? But they risk their lives in ways that are incredible tragedies for their families and elevate the cause of the brutality of ICE into the national conversation, right? And so there's a similar kind of way where somebody like my father he's not going to get killed, but you don't know whether you're going to be Goodman, Cheney, or Schwerner either.
To that point, oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I have two thoughts. I think Omar's points are really well taken and so are Annie's. But two things that I think about. One is talking to my students. And if you go look out in this audience, I'm not going to guess the median age here. I'm not going to do that. But if you go to the No Kings protests like that, what is the median age there? Our friend Dana Fisher, right? It's like it's 60s, mm-hmm. right? So there's two questions I have. One, where are the young people? And I think that's a really important question. I have some thoughts later. But the second thing, and when you were talking about what happened in Minneapolis, or even more recently, go back to the pardoning of the January 6th people, the sure. slush fund that's being set up. I did a lot of work in Ukraine, and I had my friends from Ukraine are like sending me messages on WhatsApp being like, why aren't you guys out in the streets? Like, why is there not stuff happening? And it's a great question because it's ridiculous, right? From a political science standpoint, we can call it that. That's a technical term. It's ridiculous. But in a lot of other countries that have experienced similar things, there's been bigger civil resistance. There's been bigger uprising. We can talk about elites, like where they have been, like universities, business leaders, people whose bottom line. And the third thing I just want to just say is the bigger question is, why hasn't it not been bigger? And that goes also to Annie's point.
Well, to your point about elites, let's talk about Gaza for just one second.
Yeah.
I know it's still, and it should be a hot button topic. Elite universities that produce people that are going to go work for the companies that make the bombs, that institute the laws that repress Palestinians, said no. That's what shocked me the most about those protests on those college campuses. We know who Columbia reproduces. We know who USC reproduces. Let's not be silly here and not know that these are elite institutions that produce people that go work for places like McKinsey, right? And these kids see a live stream genocide and say enough. For the most part, probably I feel really comfortable that everybody here probably went to a protest or at least retweeted something really like F the man, right? I feel comfortable in this room saying that. That being said, slush fund aside, because the Trump discussion is that's a whole other show. I can come back if you like. But when we see George Floyd, the country burns. We saw Freddie and Good killed in real time. And it was more tisk tisk. Maybe some major metropolitan areas had some protests or some die-ins. There were some things that happened. I'm not going to be that flippant and say no one did anything anywhere.
Yeah.
But to the level that we saw, if George Floyd dies in 2019, does the country burn? Do we have to have all of those things working at the same time? Trump, Proud Boys, COVID shelter in place orders, the fear of what this virus may be, the fear of another administration, Black Lives Matter gets their last hurrah, if you will, before they go to the sunset of foundation money. But all jokes aside, I was shocked that I didn't see more. Were we scared as a nation?
I ponder this so much. I talk to lots of different activists. I don't think that we were scared of getting shot. And there was ice watch trainings the days after he was killed where 200,000 people signed up for that. I don't know, and I just look at those massive protests in the streets in other countries with enormous envy. I don't know why we don't have that, but I think there's a lot of deep systemic reasons.
Yeah.
One is, I believe, is that we have no social safety net here. And so people are scared, I think, less of getting shot and more of losing the grip that they just barely have on their economic stability. And I used to be the executive director of Greenpeace US. Once a year, we would meet with all the other Greenpeaces from around the world. And in Europe, these people are like, I was really pissed, so I took 3 months off to go protest. I'm like, what? You took 3 months off? How'd you go to the doctor?
Like, it's a sabbatical.
Yeah, it's just our country, I believe, intentionally makes it so hard to survive here that people have our nervous systems are scared more than being scared about being shot. I often think the biggest thing we could do to promote a robust, escalating, consistent protest is pass universal health care. Because, people are one paycheck away from losing their house, not being able to go, if they lose your job, not being able to go to the doctor. And so I want to come back to this thing about young people. Andre and I have just been on a tour around the country doing our book events. The one question we were asked everywhere is, where are the young people? It's the one question. And so I'm irritated by this question. Actually, I want Scott to chime in because we were just talking about this. Because the fact that young people are not at the protests you were at doesn't mean they're not organizing. Okay, so that's one thing.
It's fair.
Second thing I want to say is, when I graduated Columbia University in 1986, right? Yes, the world was my oyster. The economy was more stable. I could do so many different things. Kids are graduating now with massive student loan, 3 jobs. None of them can afford the kind of house they grew up in. It's a tough place. So if we want to see more people, young people protest, let's create a more equitable, secure society so that they have that space. And then the other thing, I lost it in Denver when someone asked about where the young people. I said, they were just out protesting for Gaza a lot. And you know what happened to them? They got deported. They got arrested. They got expelled. They got tear gassed. Where were you? Where were we? Did we have their backs? We can't be like, no, we don't want you protesting on that. We want you protesting on this. If we want to see more young people protest, first of all, look at where they are organizing. And second of all, create a society and culture that has their back. The Columbia situation I find especially interesting because when I was at Columbia, I slept out in an encampment on Hamilton Hall steps to protest the apartheid, to call in the
Those were things they were proud of, right?
Yeah.
1969 or 68 in Columbia.
On their website, they're so proud of it. It's on their website that they were the first school, university that divested from South Africa. The Gaza protesters protested in the exact same spot. And so I actually did organize a bunch of their alumni to pressure the university and say no. But the thing is, if we want to see more young people protest and if we want to see more protest overall, we have to create a society that makes it, facilitates people protesting, because this is just a really hard country to survive in when you're on the edge, which half of the country doesn't have $400 for an emergency?
You leave me out of this.
Anyway, so that's some thoughts.
But take your point, but it's not like the economic conditions have changed dramatically from 2020. It's not like people are worse off now than they were in the civil rights era.
What do you think? Why are there less people protesting?
You're saying black people in the South are worse off now than they were then?
No, white.
white people in the South or just white people in Berkeley?
I'm not going to negotiate this. Like, we see episodic waves of protest irrespective of the broader economic conditions. And so it's not that your points aren't well taken, but it's hard to explain Gaza or BLM if it's all about structure. People have agency. They get mobilized by an idea or an issue or an injustice. And I think what you've got in this moment, I don't have any grand theory of the what's happened. I would say one footnote is that when I went to the No Kings San Francisco protest, there were a lot of young people. So I think one, it's important just to question the assumption.
Yeah.
A second thing is that it's like we're in this moment, and this is, we're all experiencing this, of like, there are so many issues simultaneously that it's actually very hard to latch onto one thing. And part of what we've seen historically, again, whether it's Selma or George Floyd, or for that matter, LA 92, seeing an image of the state engaging in brutal repression is enraging and interpretable to us. It makes sense. This is wrong, and I don't want to be, and I want to take a stand. Whereas a $1.8 billion slush fund is, it's not visual, it's not visceral, it's hard to get mobilized. And so I think that's a challenge of a certain kind of protest, is it requires a level of rage that bureaucratic malfeasance doesn't lend itself to.
A golden statue might, though.
Can I ask you guys this question?
No. Could I say something on this question first?
Of course you can.
Yeah. Just kind of thinking about, actually, I feel like there's two questions being talked about here, is why are we not seeing masses of people doing things? And then the other is like, where are the youth? I feel like we're seeing lots of people turn out for No Kings and lots of more permanent rallies, even in rural East Texas, which is actually where I'm from. Right? People turn out in places like Bider, Texas, and they definitely turned out in 2020.
Yikes.
But they were still turning out in No Kings rallies. And then, you know, for people to engage in this sort of militant disruption, like, which I actually feel like is what we saw in Los Angeles and Chicago and Minneapolis definitely this year, which is, I think, really important. And I didn't say this in the first thing I said earlier, is like, but you're right. There was a lot of organizing that went on. People were very well organized in Minneapolis. Upwards of 80,000 people were involved in disruptive activities, documenting activities, patrol activities. I have a good friend in Minneapolis who has two toddlers, and everyone who took their kids to his daycare, because there were people who worked there were undocumented, like, basically started a daycare watch, right? People were very well organized and very disruptive to the ICE system. We're seeing things at that level, but the fact that we're not seeing people shut down highways like they did in Argentina during an economic crisis in the early 2000s, or when they overthrew all these different ex-Soviet blocs, I think part of it is, I don't think there's actually that much direction being, there's not a lot of leadership saying, here's who to go after. I think that's part of it. I think the opposition does have leadership, and they are passing things like a presidential national security memo, which actually is targeting the left.
Yes.
And which is targeting people who fund the left.
So you're talking about national, tell them NPSM -7.
Yeah. Yeah. National Presidential Security Memo.
Memorandum. Yeah.
Memorandum 7. Right. And then they just came out with a counterterror strategy just in the last week, targeting the left, anti-Christian, anti-American groups, and Trump's anti-trans, and Trump's scientists, we will find you and we will kill you.
Yeah.
Right? And so, like, I think that is, people are, like, much more cautious than they were. I think youth are much more cautious. I actually just coincidentally, for a friend, I went to a party, social and liberation rally last weekend in East Oakland, and everyone there was under 30, definitely under 40. I was definitely the oldest person there. It was also a very diverse crowd. It wasn't very white at all. I feel like a lot of the youth are actually very involved in politics and radical politics, and they're both working inside the system and outside the system. And there's a lot of organizing going on all the time. The crew who I organized with here in the Bay Area after Renee Good and Alex Preddy got murdered, is that we organize trainings pretty regularly. Some of my co-trainers are here, and we had 30, 40, 50 people turn out. It looked a lot like the people who were in this room, but there's still a lot of people turning out to stuff.
Is that an outreach issue?
I actually, and I come from a long line of campaigning, strategic campaigning. I actually feel like part of it is, like, people will go do stuff if they actually think there's something that's going to work.
Efficacy.
So you think that people see this as somewhat futile? futile?
At a certain level, yeah. I think people want to do things where they win. And we, like we've said, there hasn't been a lot of political victories. If we start seeing some political victories, or we start being part of political victories, I think things will change. I think there was we moved the needle on police murder of Black people. In my mind, we moved the country, at least in people's minds, in 2020. We didn't necessarily defund the police, but I feel like there was actually some motion in there, momentum in there that was actually really effective.
If that rhetorical needle did move, again, I'm just asking the question here. If that rhetorical needle did move, what does that mean in the grand scheme of things? Does it just mean more Black female police chiefs in Atlanta? Does it mean representation won out at the end of the day? Or does it mean we care a little differently? I can only know about the Bay Area now from the news.
Right.
And boy, oh boy, I'm scared to park my car here because you people aren't bipping me. If you go back and watch any news coverage from about right around the COVID time to the Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and then George Floyd, there were tons of police stories about people getting their behinds kicked by the cops. And that changes as soon as we're really locked in. And then you start seeing a bunch of colored kids running into a CVS and Ross Dressed for Less. And oh my God, they shot somebody in Chinatown. And that becomes the story. So we're no longer talking about police repression. We're talking about hordes of young people and property crime. I'm 48 years old. I grew up in Richmond, California in the 90s. I have been shot at. I know all about crack, not from the usage standpoint, but from the drug dealing standpoint. That was a violent time. This is not that time. It's not even close to that time. But when I see the news, you would think it's 1988 all over again. You would think Felix Mitchell rose from the grave and is doing drive-bys in the 6ix9ine Village. That's just not what it is. But the narrative changed so hard. I don't hear the talks about defunding the police. The NAACP a few years ago actually put out a memo to Oakland to say, please do not fire police officers. Again, I'm not disagreeing with you that the rhetoric changed. I'm just asking what came of it.
I don't know if anything, I don't think anything materially came of it. And I definitely think maybe it's also been walked back some too.
I think so.
Yeah. I think that's an important part of what's happened too.
That's what scared me the most personally.
I think when if we're able to change people's thoughts and behaviors and things and we don't act on it and get some sort of material change, then it just goes back.
But do you think, though, we have a moment? Let's stay there for 1 second before we start taking audience questions. There is a moment where language really does change. We really have embraced 90s political correctness, right? I grew up saying horrible things. If somebody was lame, they were gay. I grew up saying mean things like that. I do not say those things anymore, right? I do still say the N-word from time to time. I have a potty mouth, I'm sorry. But seriously, language really did change. And it did feel like there was a 180-degree shift. HR speak is starting to go the way of the dodo now with the second term of this administration. So do you think that moment in the sun is over?
Are you asking me or?
I'm asking everybody.
I think we don't know yet.
Okay.
Because we don't know if it's backsliding or if it's backlash to the progress we are making. So we don't know yet. It's to be determined.
I want to agree. Sorry.
I was just going to say a lot of the things we feel like we're losing environmental rights, we're losing trans rights, we're losing gay rights, we're losing women's choices. But look at the longer arc. Things are so much better on so many fronts than they were in the past. So maybe this is, maybe the moral arc of the universe still does bend towards justice, but it's just not a smooth bend.
I hope you're right. Yeah.
I hope I'm right.
So I would add, I agree that we don't know and that you can look at, again, a movement like the Black Freedom Struggle. There are decades upon decades where there's no sign of progress. And then there's this 10-year window where Jim Crow is toppled. On the other side, you can look at the anti-abortion movement. They spend 50 years trying to overthrow Roe, and they pull it off, right? Yeah. And it's a 50-year movement.
And a small number of people, too.
And there are a lot of moments where you could say, oh, we're making no progress, and that misses the kind of slow, long fuse burn of what actually is happening. And so I would agree that it's like it's very hard to, in the moment, understand what's going on. Two things I would underline from what both of you said are what we see in the 1960s, and this is like the core of my research, is there's like when the data I have suggests that when protesters engage in violence, and that includes things like property damage, injury, death, arson, it tends to harm the movement. And it doesn't really matter whether the state is engaging in brutal repression at the same time. The story, exactly as you said, I literally think of it as a lens. The camera moves from a focus on injustice to a focus on pathology. And you change the story. And to be clear, the deck is stacked against focusing on injustice, right? It wants to go to pathology. So it's a very hard thing to sustain for a movement to keep. And of course, people like Stokely Carmichael said, I've been beaten and arrested 14 times. I'm tired of this. I'm not signing up for that anymore, right? You can understand that it's very hard to ask people to put themselves in the line of fire. But movements are episodic. They tend to be also somewhat, entropic. There's a moment of focus, and then you get people, radical factions or just individuals engaging in things that kind of can cast a shadow over a whole movement. It's very hard to sustain focus over a long period of time. Yeah. And so there's both, I think, an optimistic story that the book is not yet written, but also, it's a real issue that it's exceedingly hard to sustain a movement over a long arc of time. And it often tends to dissipate into something more chaotic.
My co-host, who's a history professor, maybe he's watching us tonight out there. Hi, Bob.
So, Bob.
Frames it as a movement moment. And then we have these sort of bursts or these moments, whether it's labor or women's rights or civil rights, and then it goes away, shrinks, contracts.
Can you just say, so first of all, I think these are really good points, but I also want to point out and come back to something, the elites, right? And I'll say this as somebody who's wearing sneakers, so clearly I'm an elitist at my core, but I am an elitist. I'm an elitist in the sense that I think movements matter, but when it comes to democratic politics and a lot of the things that we are thinking about, these business, wealthy tech folks, like party insiders, all these people, that's where the pressure needs to be applied. And it's those people, like in my view, those are the people, like whether it be in Ukraine or Turkey or military folks, all those sorts of people that have power, whether it be economic or otherwise, those are the people that matter in this game. And what we have right now is Trump is incredibly unpopular, and he's probably going to get more unpopular, I would guess. I'm not to go, but he's not going to get super popular before the election. And his incentive to engage in repression is higher. But at the same time, people wanting to hitch their ride to the Trump machine, that's changing. And so I don't know what that means, but I will say that come 2026, and especially 2028, we should be expecting a lot of repression coming down and a lot of uncertainty. And whether that's effective or not, I think that's something that's what the research would suggest, is a leader who's declining, he's already setting the stage for different things. And then the question is, how are elites going to respond? And that's where movement
is. This a different moment for us, though? And I'll end with this question.
Yeah.
We want to take audience questions after this.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're actually under time if you want, even a second question.
Okay. Are Americans becoming desensitized to state violence because it is now consumed as content in the same feed as sports highlights and memes? Yes.
What I'm seeing is less of a desensitization and more of a not knowing what to do. People are unclear what the levers are. We've been doing these freedom trainer trainings around the country. Everyone's like, just tell me what to do. What to do. So I think if there was a clear understanding of a theory and clear discipline and alignment around a theory of change and understanding where those levers were, I think we'd see a lot more people being involved. I don't think there's a desensitization. What I'm saying.
Is there an atomization of people in general? Because when we talk about these protest movements of decades past, these movements took place where people were in close community. For example, we're talking about the civil rights movement, the Black church looks extremely different in 2026 than it did in 1956.
I think that's huge. I read one study about the students in Freedom Summer. I'd love you to ask your dad if this was true and tell me about what was the commonality of the students who stayed after the three murders? And I'm a parent, so I was like, oh, their parents supported them, or they had credit cards. I was trying to figure out what it was. And the most common factor that they all had if they stayed was they had friends there.
Okay, McAdams research.
Yeah. And think the more that we have friends, and that's why a big No Kings has a real value in getting people together, talking to your neighbors. The more that we are in this together, the more that we are in this together. So I think that's building community is so huge.
Another thing that your question was, what was the first question again? It was not about the atomization.
Oh, no. Are Americans becoming desensitized to state violence because it's being consumed as content?
Yeah. So I think my impression is that we've got two things that sort of are maybe were true then and are true now. People are desensitized to a degree, right? A video of police killing is now something that's routine. The sort of thing when I was a kid, there was like, I remember people, boys being excited that there were videos of like snuff film, not anybody wanted to watch it, but it was like, you would talk about like this, like crazy thing that people had videos of live deaths on VHS cassettes. and that's just, that's a routine thing you encounter now on social media. It's not taboo. It's like these things. Yes, at some level, there's a kind of desensitizing that has to come with that, I think. It gets normalized. And again, Good and Pretty showed that we're not so desensitized that it doesn't at times cause the entire country to be like, whoa, this is somehow not the entire country. The entire country is paying attention, and a majority of the country says this crosses a line. And so there's similar kinds of things in the 1960s where there's part of what is obvious to people who are in the movement, but was a revelation to me, was how strategic those movement leaders were, right? So they don't just happen to end up in Birmingham. They pick Birmingham because they know the police chief will engage in spectacles of violence. And they go into protests knowing that they are going to be targets, right? And so they're using violence strategically, but they're making themselves the objects of violence with the idea that's going to be on the front page of newspapers around the world. And that is a kind of, it's almost like a bank shot. We're not going to win this battle, but we're going to mobilize people outside of the South and outside of America to come to our side, right? And it's an exceedingly, it works, right? And so I think that tactic, again, I don't mean to keep coming back to it. The young man who's killed is Jimmie Lee Jackson, but Viola Liuzzo and Jimmie Lee Jackson and James Reeb, a young minister, their killings do shock the conscience of the nation. And so I think you can have a long period where it seems like people are desensitized, and then certain kinds of images just punch through.
We're centering that kind of in the past. And I think the issue with centering that in the past is that it's back to the whole social safety net. Everything's a little different for people. You can take some time off school, go protest, get your ass kicked by the cops, go back, finish university, become a congressman, run for president, lose a couple times. There's a lot of things you can do in the 60s, right? And there's a counter-hegemonic force in the Soviet Union. And I'm not glorifying any of these politicians that were in power at the time, but politics looks a little different in 1965, as horrible as Jim Crow is. Still looks different than it does today, because now we're in the era of maybe, and I hate to say the ification of things, but like the Israelification of law enforcement, where we will shoot you. You can stream it if you want to. We just don't care. We'll shoot your medics. We'll shoot your press. And we don't care.
But at the core of the model I have about how protests work through media is you do need to be in a semi-democratic society, right? Where there is a functioning media. And what we saw around BLM was there was a ton of coverage of police violence against protesters, right? And so I think part of I don't think that we don't care. And again, like in Minneapolis, we don't care blew up on the administration. So I am not sure that model actually is the present. I think we do have a sufficiently vibrant media in the US that it does in fact serve as a check.
I would push back slightly in the sense that I don't see a desensitization to violence, but I do think the media ecosystem has definitely changed in terms of who is bought. We've seen the Paramount merger, what's happened to Twitter, X. So I do think that is different. So I would say it's not so much desensitization, but maybe the channels and what content. There's a ton of studies as to what the content has changed on X, the algorithm, but also more generally, this kind of right-wing sort of oligarchs who have made it a project to purchase news. Fox News is way more important in terms of politics, I think, than a lot of other sort of mainstream media stations. It doesn't mean things can't break through, right? They do. It's just harder. The threshold is higher. But the other thing, too, that I do think is important is having done work in places like Turkey and Ukraine is that I think it's hard to talk to. I live in D.C., friends that work in politics, and it's unclear if people recognize that is this a midterm waves coming and this is politics as usual versus in those places that we're used to authoritarian maneuvers and are like, this is what it actually means to be an opposition party. And they have protest movements and other things. And I think in Ukraine, for instance, they had the Orange Revolution. They had a history of protest. There was a theory of change, but they also had an infrastructure. And I think in the U.S., it's not clear what that is right now. And there's not that story. So I think young kids were the young kids. It's like, why would I risk my job for an uncertain story or an uncertain outcome that could cost me a lot potentially? What's the theory of change? And
I think that's a problem, Scott? Is there no real infrastructure for these movements?
I didn't say there's no real infrastructure. I just say in these other places, there's a lot more and there's a history of it.
Don't try to save yourself now.
Yeah.
There's not enough infrastructure.
There's definitely not enough for the size of the country.
Yep. And for the need.
Yeah. And for the need compared to somewhere like France or other places in Europe or other parts of the world.
But the Yellow Vest was somewhat of a disparate movement, much like the trucker convoy that happened in Canada, right?
It's a different kind,
Is it just the size? Does the size matter?
I think the size matters. I think the media ecosystem matters. Mm-hmm. I think the large amounts of money put in the opposition matter. Mm-hmm. I think that the supposed opposition party, I don't really consider them an opposition party, but they work against protest movements as much as the far right does.
Yeah.
And so I think institutionally, there's a lot of things marshaled against us. And I think that the infrastructure and the institutions we have on the left, or even like the progressive liberal left or whatever, is like nothing in comparison to what we're looking at. I think I'm a true believer in underdogs. I've been doing this work for 25 years. I'm not going to stop anytime soon, but there's a lot against us. And I'm not trying to be fatalist here either.
We've talked, right?
I do believe we'll win. I think the arc of history is long and always bends towards justice.
Long
I do
bumpy.
Believe that.
But look, I know you brought,
it's scary right now, though.
But you brought up the memorandum, here's the question. So, for instance, question? Yeah. So you asked, what does it mean to have protest infrastructure? What is that? And having an opposition party, what does that mean in other places? For instance, in Ukraine, there were local civil society groups who had party apparatus, who also had groups, organizations, media, and also had connections to national politicians, right? Some of whom had been in prison, a woman named Yulia Tymoshenko. You can remember she's got the kind of Princess Leia buns. But there's basically an assumption that they were working through that we are going to be targeted. We need to figure out ways to both work within the system, but also have pressure outside. And so it's because this generally deeper, there's not a better way to say it, but there are these structures both at the local level and national level where there were and they also had elites backing them. Take a protest movement like the Tea Party movement was not a big movement, but it was effective. And it's because it had the Koch brothers behind them.
Believe we call that astroturfed.
Yeah, but you don't have to have and that's where the elites come in to have that kind of stuff. I want to ask Scott, though, too, because you brought up the point about it's tough now. This is what kind of presidential memorandum, NSPM-7, it basically ties Antifa to open society.
They're trying to make it global. Yeah. You understand that. I'm sure we all read the New York Times article where Sebastian Gorka, who's leading that charge, good times, they're trying to align it with other quote-unquote anti-fascist movements in places like Greece and Italy. And so they can say, okay, if you're part of Antifa in Berkeley, California, then you're tied to it and you're a global terrorist organization, and we're going to put you under the jail. We're seeing people get charged right now for very tepid protesting that are facing tons of years. To make that pivot from white supremacist violence, and we have to admit, when we think about political violence in this country, are you really scared about some college students that want to blow up empty buildings? Or are you scared of someone that watched the massacre of children and then blew up and massacred more children, right? In Timothy McVeigh. These are the people that for decades, the state said, especially after the fall of the Soviet Union, this is the problem. It's these white dudes that live out in the mountains that have military training and guns, right? If this is where they want to raid, it's like, you guys have your priorities all effed up because I'm not armed, right? So that's where my fear comes into play when you talk about that memorandum, that now these things that people wore as badges of honor, especially when they went to protest, I'm Black Bloc, I'm Antifa, now that comes at a real, put you in real prison price, Fed mandatory minimum prison price. What do you do now, Scott?
What do I do now? I mean, I think that it's the moment to organize, right?
Yeah.
It's like where we get more people involved. It's where we get people finding their courage.
Yeah.
Finding your courage is a big thing that we talk about in our trainings these days, because it's a pretty scary time, right? And we did this training back in March or April, and it was after the murders of Renee Good and Alex Preddy, and we had to talk to them about, we don't necessarily think the San Francisco police are going to pull their guns out on you, but ICE will, ICE might, and we had to talk to them about how to deal with that, right? Which is the run. Or hide behind an engine block, right? The trainer here who did that is nodding at me right now. But I think what we need to do is, the more people we have in the streets, you can see how much they freaked out just with No Kings, like the opposition did. I think more people in the streets, more people organized, more people taking action, more people building community and supporting each other is actually what we need to be doing. That's the important thing.
And part of what I hear in what you're saying, which I think is so important, is
building infrastructure too.
But it building... So I teach a film and politics class, and a bunch of the films I teach look at protest movements, and we can learn from a movement like ACT UP, but we can also watch a film like How to Survive a Plague and see that people were up against, the film is literally, the title is not hyperbolic, right? People were facing death sentences, and their activism was about both elevating their cause, gaining dignity, but fundamentally about trying to find a cure for a deadly disease. And it's a remarkable movement, and it was incredibly successful in a relatively narrow band of time. We can look at, there's a great film on Apple TV called Death President Now, about the takeover of Gallaudet University. There's another one, any case, there's lots of inspiration to take from the past. Crip Camp, another good example. The birth of the disability rights movement. And the point is, you're absolutely right. It is definitely a scary time, and we are not up against worse things than our forebears were up against. And people have looked in the face of more repressive regimes, more brutal police forces, and come together and taken and toppled those governments. And so I think I think your point about courage is fundamental, and that we can take inspiration from the past and bring that to bear on the present. And then the last thing I would say is just drawing on work by Erica Chenoweth and Maria Steven, who are also political scientists who've done very influential work about how nonviolence can be effective, is in these other countries, the movements tend to have a broader array of tactics, where it's like there is a work stoppage, there is an effort to do targeted boycotts that really put pressure on business elites. And the gift and the curse of America is, we are so large, it's just vastly harder to coordinate a large group of Americans. There is no town square in the big city that we can all converge in. And so the gift of that is that it's also much harder to do a takeover. And the curse of it, it's much harder to organize at scale.
I'm glad you mentioned Erica Chenoweth and Maria Steffens. I want to say two things. One is the question about the infrastructure. The kind of infrastructure that we don't have enough of here is training, is clear decision-making hierarchy and decision-making processes so that when a protest opens up a movement, we aren't able to, we aren't able to seize it, is legal, is communication, and is really importantly is cross-sector, cross-pillar organizing. I was actually on a call with Erica Chenoweth today, and she said there is no place where there has been a successful movement to oust an authoritarian regime and get back on the democratic path that did not have a united democratic alliance or something cross-sector. And one of the challenges we have is that our movement culture tends to be suspicious to hostile of decision-making hierarchy, of engaging across differences, across society. We are not inclined to taking orders. I read this fascinating book called How to Read a Protest that compared the signs at the March on Washington to the Women's March. And at the March on Washington, everybody had approved signs. And if you had a sign that was not approved, a group of volunteers would get around you and take it away.
Well, yeah.
And there were reasons why, because Washington, D.C. was so freaked out about all these black men coming to town. They wanted to communicate and signal extreme discipline. And can you imagine at the Women's March, if a bunch of volunteers got around you and said, no, you can't have that sign? We don't like being told what to do. And so we're having a hard time getting information that we need to do to take over. So that's one challenge. The other challenge, I think, is, Scott, you said we need a lot more people. We absolutely need a lot more people, for sure. And we need a different set of strategies than the ones in our toolbox that we have honed over years. And I think that's really hard. So I've been an environmental activist for 40 years. I know how to harass corporations. I know how to harass politicians, all this stuff. I have a toolbox of things. Those don't work in this authoritarian context. And so we're being asked to show up in a way that we have an aversion to and that we don't know how to do. And I think that's a real problem, that we need to evolve. We need to grow our scale and we need to grow our strategic toolbox.
So one thing I would say is I think actually strategy is key. And there's an exercise that I've used for a long time. I've trained on it called the Pillars of Power, where we look at the different institutions that are holding up the authoritarian regime, for example. And those are tangible things. Those are like corporate. With actually ICE, one of the things that activists have been doing this year is they've been targeting the corporations which actually have been supporting ICE, right? Or police. There's a huge uprising going on in Bolivia right now. People have been following that in the news. There's stories now coming out that the police are beginning to defect and join the protesters, right? And so I'm not a fan of the police. I would never really be nice about the police. But an important thing is if we turn the military and the police against the state, then that's a pathway to victory. So there's a lot of pieces that do this as long as we're strategic and we actually think about how to dismantle the regimes we're going after. The other thing you talked about, Leslie Kaufman's book, How to Read a Protest. Mm-hmm. She actually wrote another great book called Direct Action, which is a history of direct action. And so what I would say is that a lot of what we talk about with protest, I think we've gotten way deeper in this conversation. But when people think about protest, they think marching on a weekend, holding signs. And I think that's all very important. I see that as what I refer to often as a gateway drug. And I think actually it's direct action is what we really need. Nonviolent direct action is what we really need.
Non-cooperation.
But things like strikes, sit-ins and factories, all of this thing which really disrupts the status quo is actually really what's important. And that tying that in with that Pillars of Power analysis is actually what's going to be really important.
Yes.
Do we want to take...
Now my strategic campaigner is coming up.
Do we want to take some questions from the audience now?
Yeah. Do you want to take some... You want to play Donahue?
I want it. Where's the microphone?
They're right over there. Oh, and one other thing I'll real quick say real quick, too, is that there's been a call for a general strike in this country in 2028. And every space I go into, people are building towards that. So I think that's also really important just to kind of say that.
And the organizing around the midterms. There's a lot of really good organizing about what are we going to do in our communities when the midterms are hijacked, disrupted, not enforced, et cetera.
when the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act. And since then, I've heard that there's a call for some version in the South, especially, of having a Freedom Summer this summer. And I was wondering, that sounded to me like a really good idea, where that is, if people know.
Do you know where Freedom Summer is?
So I just echoing this point about the tactics of the past may or may not always translate to the present. Part of what made Freedom Summer work was the murder of Goodman. This is very top of mind for me, and I'm still processing this trip. But in a way, Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner being murdered made Freedom Summer a success. Incredible, but it's not. I was just in Mississippi, like the number one, a huge tourist destination is the Civil Rights Museum, right? It's not, we're not going to be able to reproduce Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner. Again, incredible tragedy to those families. I am not trying to minimize the loss, but from the movement perspective, it was like a very changed things. I don't know that Freedom Summer, I think you're absolutely right that making voting rights a big issue this summer is, I could hardly be more enthusiastic. I don't have but I think the question that was posed before about what's, think of the challenge as how do you create a kind of morality play that gets elevated in national media where you're the good guy and your opposition is the bad guy, to make it very simple. And I think that's actually like how a lot of politics works.
Yeah.
And when things are more technical, it's like, what's the rules of gerrymandering, right? It's like, you don't have a embodied enemy like Bull Connor. You don't have an embodied image like young people being hit with fire hoses.
Is that one of the problems that we're seeing right now? There's a bit of a simplification, especially the way we understand the civil rights movement. We understand that moment. There's a certain iconography to that era that we're addicted to a certain extent. That's gone with what we saw now, because I can still vote.
Yeah, I think part of the challenge is how to identify an issue where you can capture the moral high ground, and not every issue has that. And sometimes when you capture the moral high ground on one issue, you can then use that as leverage on others, right? So the question I would ask, and I'm not on the front lines of this, I would want to listen to organizers in Mississippi, but the question is, where is the leverage point? Where can one capture, what is the thing that's going to generate particularly compelling stories in the culture elevate your cause and make the injustice, the wrongful actions of the people you oppose stark, right? You're trying to, and I don't know in the present day on voting, I think that's going to be challenging.
I don't know, because people are worried their vote doesn't count. What kind of a democracy?
But that's not quite right. It's more complicated than that. People will get to vote. They won't get their representative.
It won't mean anything in many places.
The larger point is just, some issues lend themselves to a certain kind of tactic, and Freedom Summer, I don't know that's replicable.
Some issues and some moments.
Yeah.
Is there any questions? Oh.
I wrote a book too, and it's called Levitating the Pentagon and Other Uplifting Stories. I've in the last couple of months, I've been to a few meetings, and two of them had 500 people each in them. And most of them were not old people. Most of them were young people and very diverse. And one of them was about the embargo of weapons to Israel. And there were 500 people in the Islamic temple downtown. And then the second one was a report back from Minneapolis that was given in Ed Roberts Center near Ashby Bart, near where I live. So I walked over there and I was amazed to see 500 people there for a report back. And most of them were young. So I think it was Anne who said, we have to pay attention to what they're doing if we want to understand what they're doing. So also, I don't know what people think, but there's lots of organizing going on in the area, in neighborhoods. They're small, relatively now. There's one in my neighborhood, and I don't think we're completely all hooked up with each other. And we also aren't 100% sure of what to do. And I think I agree with that too, that what nonviolent disruption, yeah, okay, but there are a lot of forms that takes, and we haven't figured out exactly what it would look like now in this era. I'm a little optimistic. I this isn't a question, but I think that the country, consciousness in the country has changed dramatically. I'm 82 from when I was a kid, and I think we are living through a counter revolution of sorts, and it's deep and it's wide and it's bad. But I think, I don't know, Gramsci said he was a pessimist of the intellect and an optimist of the will. And I think that's what we have to be. And we have to just keep on keeping on.
We got another question over here.
Give me a second. I'll get there shortly. Got a first Gramsci quote of the night.
The one about the interregnum. And I have a couple observations and a couple of questions. One observation is that we had an election in New York City last year where a Democratic Socialist was elected. And the people who elected him were, by most reports, some close to 100,000 young people going door to door. So I was wondering, we haven't talked about elections here except glancingly. So how does a protest election fit in with the topic of the protests tonight? What might that mean in terms of reverberations with other kinds of protests? Also, nobody's dropped the F-bomb here tonight. Nobody's said the word fascism. And I'm wondering if you think that it is fascism that we are experiencing in this counter-revolution, whatever you want to call it, and if that matters, that it is fascism, and whether people in the United States, it would be helpful for the struggle if we use the term. Are there enough people in the United States who know what that means for it to be useful?
Yeah.
Wage in on the fascism debate?
So I'll first say, I think the other part that you said about Mamdani, and if you watch Mamdani, he's the joyful warrior, but he's, I hate to use this word, but he's charismatic, right? And it's, you know it when you see it. He has, even Trump was taken in by his charisma, which is, yeah. So I think that's something, but I think that speaks to a deeper question is we're also, in terms of leftist politics more generally, there's a massive change. Nancy Pelosi's, all these leaders from the civil rights era or the 60s, 70s, right? There's a change that happens. And so there's also parties are built of factions. And so we will see which faction takes over and who those different leaders are. Now about the fascism label, do I think there are appropriations of fascist iconography and weird meme culture? The Department of Homeland Security Instagram account, I think a lot of people don't look at, but that's a lot of that is white nationalist rhetoric. Do I think labeling that will change things? No, but I also think what I do believe is true is that the problem that we have, and it goes to this kind of thing, is what is going to break through, right? And I think, unfortunately, people don't play that much, that a lot of people don't pay that close of attention to politics. And so it's finding those stories that stick. The Voting Rights Act and some of the Supreme Court stuff, those are really huge stories. But I think to most people, it's hard to get people to wrap their heads around it. And the people on the left are still trying to come up with a story. Personally, I've seen it in other countries. I think corruption works as a story and a frame, and it's very simple. And that's something that I think people should not be afraid to say if they see it, because even somebody like Bill Kristol, who is no fan of the left, when he's retweeting things about put them all on trial for corruption and bring in the hate, that suggests that there is a resonance there. But I do think that's a big and important story about elections and movements, right? Because parties are built like kind of movements and factions. We don't yet know who the next leader on the left will be. And maybe it's Mamdani, maybe it's somebody else, maybe it's Assaf. Maybe there are a lot of people who are very charismatic and young and ambitious, and we don't know where that will take us yet.
But on the Mamdani point,
yeah,
I wouldn't throw it just into charisma, because there were the 100,000 of them that put him there as well. And we have now in the United States more elected socialists than we've had since the turn of the last century. There are over 250 democratic socialists in office now in various levels around the country. Not all of them are charismatic. There's something else happening.
For sure. But I do think like Mamdani is a generational political talent. And I think that's part of it. And I think don't be afraid.
And New York isn't Seattle, right?
Yeah. But yeah,
like there's massive differences between New York and Seattle if we're going to look at.
Which is also.
Can anybody here name the mayor of Seattle? It's one person. There's also Giggles. People don't know her name.
Can I say something to Fred's question?
Sure.
I think the other thing around the sort of like protests slash elections is I think it's going to, whatever, I think we all see where there's state Senate races in Texas and Louisiana where it's these massive flips against the right. And my dopamine flows when that happens, right? I get very excited about it. I think actually the other important thing happening, which is part of the sort of like protest elections component, is that we're actually seeing a lot of these more centrist establishment Democrats, incumbent Democrats, and Cuomo is the shining example of that, beaten by the charismatic Mamdani. But like, we're seeing a lot of like, these Democratic centrists supportive of Israel losing or getting like seriously challenged more than we've actually seen in a long time this year. It happened in Philly this week, right? And so I think that we've talked a lot. Tonight's conversation has been a lot of context around protest movements versus authoritarianism or this new neo Jim Crow or whatever. But I think it's actually really important that we're seeing it happen against the Democratic establishment and the Democratic leadership.
But do you think that, so what I think is interesting though, is there are people who I would not consider super left. I don't know, Chris Hollins, the senator from Maryland.
Right.
Who I don't think is particularly left wing, but is also much more aggressive in calling out the administration for authoritarian tactics and saying we can't cooperate. So I do think there is this thing that's happening too now in left politics, where it's not so much as what is your view on Medicare for all? It's more, what do you feel
the moment back?
Yeah. What are you feeling in the moment? And I think that's an interesting observation. Yeah.
We have
two quick comments. So one, the 100,000 are not out of nowhere, right? It comes back to this, what does infrastructure mean? Infrastructure is an organization that's been like organizing people in New York for a long time that then is able to mobilize them around a candidate. Again, the protest is this thing that's visible, but often what really matters is this civic capacity that is often not so visible. And then the second thing is I would just encourage us, and this is not a strong reaction. I think fascism is a perfectly good word, but we have a tradition. Fascism is often this thing that was in Europe, and we have a long tradition of authoritarianism in the US, and we don't need to look. So you mentioned, as you were talking about Trump, right, they're drawing on white nationalism as a set of images and rhetoric and ideas. And I don't know that works politically, but I think there's just a long history of what some political scientists call a dual state. It's like there's law and contract for some, and it's predatory for others. And that's that we don't have to look to Europe for language and tradition in this country that is deeply authoritarian.
They look to us for them.
We have a question in the back, guys.
I'll try to make it a question. Just on the election thing, I think the thing we haven't talked about is that there is actually a movement, growing movement in the U.S. to throw out all those conservative Democrats who I think in many ways are this source of a lot of our problems right now in terms of making change.
100%.
The Working Families Party has elected 120 people to office in California. In New York, the Working Families Party had as many people who voted for Mamdani on their line. They have a difference as all the Republicans that voted in New York City. But you're seeing alliances between the Working Families Party and Indivisible and et cetera, et cetera. Speaking to your surge, speaking to your sort of cross-sector, plus then around in the Bay Area, around May Day, there was alliances with labor. So I think we're seeing the coming together of that. And if nothing else, if he invalidates the election in 2026, I think if a lot of people worked on the election and it gets snatched away, that might be something that pisses them off quite a bit. But where's the role? I guess you spoke to it a little bit, but I'm interested, like, where does a whole movement like that, mainly actually in a lot of ways, people of color that are running organizations that are not so much indivisible, but like Families Party run by people of color. It's just so, somewhat different.
Maybe to just to give a response, I'm going to take a different position than let's take on the centrist Democrats. If you look at what got Orban out of power, it was a right of center coalition that included the left. And if your goal is to defend democracy, then you have to, I heard somebody say, if you're in coalition, if you agree with everybody in your coalition, you're not in a coalition, you're in a cult. And the way the pro-voting rights majority, pick your issue, is going to hold power is to win in places like Montana. And those are people, and you're going to have to build coalition with people who fundamentally disagree with you on really core issues.
Yep.
And I think strategy suggests a big tent, not a kind of a set of narrow, pure positions, but that's obviously...
Hold power. You got to hold power.
And not just hold power. In America, you've got to hold 60 Senate seats. Like, how are you going to get to 60 Senate seats?
Yeah.
We have a question right here.
Same.
Yeah, this has been a really great discussion. I appreciate hearing everybody's perspectives. One of the things, I've been wrestling with hearing a lot of the talk about protests and how we need to get lots of people out to these protests, but also do direct action. And as somebody who grew up seeing and participating in anti-war protests, growing up, the biggest protests ever, and seeing it absolutely not work at all, I have a lot of sympathy for people who don't show up to No Kings, who don't show up to any of these protests, because I don't think it looks like winning. Like, to Scott's point, I think that's actually what we need. We need people to feel like what they're doing, like it's worth their time. We are like more and more stretched in terms of trying to hang on and just keep our heads above water, that to get people to come to something, they have to feel like not regret going and to like, go and feel like, oh, we actually accomplished something. And I, like the protests are really important, though, because of the spectacle.
Yeah.
But also, we live in this hugely fractured environment where that spectacle, we're not all getting the same spectacle anymore, right? And so what function does it actually serve if it's only going around in the same small bubbles? And, like, we're here in the center of this, like, tech dystopia that has foisted that on all of us and created that ecosystem where we're now participating in going in different realities now. And I guess, like, I keep coming back to, I want to see something work. And what I saw work was, like, not going to No Kings protests, but people going, like, 10 people going to the courthouse and, like, blocking ICE from taking people from their court dates in San Francisco one day a week, and then 2 days a week, and then 3 days a week. And those were, like, young people taking a sick day so they could go cover themselves up and get beaten by ICE so that they weren't taking their neighbors and deporting them, disappearing them. But that didn't get much media attention, or when it did, it would be like people talking about, oh, look how bad ICE is, but not actually saying, hey, but also look that they were taking 5 people a day until these people started showing up, and now they've taken 2 people in 5 months on the days when people were there. And like, that news doesn't get out. And so how do we, I guess what my question to you, sorry, I rambled a lot, but like my question is, how do we now move in this new environment and give people that taste of winning that leads them to the next target? Because I see Berkeley City Council embedding fascist surveillance systems all throughout here with very little resistance. We have the targets here.
But...
you shouldn't have said that.
You gotta respond.
Oh, I was just gonna say, it's an interesting thing, because I think about a lot of places where the protests, they go, they don't do anything. And then in other places, it happens and it snowballs and you get the Berlin Wall falls. Or in Ukraine, you get the overthrow of Viktor Yanukovych, right? It's huge, right? These are huge things. And there's these weird moments, and like all of a sudden it's a few, and then it's a million, right? And a lot of times people say it happened suddenly, but then we talked about the infrastructure, right? These things are built. And so my sense is that it's slow. And then it's like a, to use like a nerdy term, it's like a punctuated equilibrium. All of a sudden it changes, And it's this thing where it's almost like a run on a bank. Yeah, I'm fine keeping my money in the bank, et cetera. And then all of a sudden you see 100 people lined up at the ATM. Like, get me my money out of the bank now. It's similar kind of with the protests. Is all of a sudden when everybody in your network is going and everybody's doing this, then I think it's changing. It's a coordination thing. And those are like, it's hard to predict and other things, but it does happen. And we know it happens, but it's rare too.
This will be the final question.
Two very quick responses there. I think one, the core of my research is influencing media. So I'm like all about influencing media, but there's a way in which we all get pundit brain, and it's, are we getting our message out? And we miss the most fundamental thing. The most fundamental thing you get from going to a protest is a feeling of being in community and of efficacy and of not being alone in your rage about some particular injustice, right? And so it's like the first success is that you are transformed in some small way by your participation in this movement. And I think we can, and again, I'm as guilty of this as anybody, but of trying to think, okay, this ball's going to hit that ball and then this is going to change. It's like, no, begin with, I just need to not feel alone. I need to be embedded in a community of people who care and to feel like my voice matters, at least here. And then there's good social psychology work that suggests other people observe this and it gives them permission to take a stand. Yeah, right?
Not coming through though these days with elephants.
I disagree, but the one other thing I would say is that there's work on what's called political hobbyism. Like a lot of us are consuming the news and think that's activism, or consuming the news and that's politics on both the left and the right.
And then starting a podcast.
Yeah. And so it's just like I think I want to underline the importance of the things that are not, it still matters even if the media doesn't cover it, because it's like, it's not hobbyism. It's not a spectator sport. You're out there doing stuff. Your friends are out there doing stuff. It transforms them. It transforms people who see them. And to this earlier point, it can actually ripple out.
Last question.
I'm a social studies teacher, so a middle school, high school. 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. I equate the right to life with the right to use the earth. But what do you suggest as a unifying principle, perhaps a talking point, using the Declaration of Independence and those inalienable rights to life as a galvanizing piece for across the political spectrum?
There are a lot of organizations working on this. Do you know about the Next 250 project? Check that out. There's a whole bunch of organizations, labor, environment, all racial justice, that have come together and put sort of their vision for what the next 250 is. To be honest, I'm not very involved in it. I'm not that interested.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Can I ask a question to the panel before we go?
Yeah.
Starting with Scott Parkin.
Okay.
Yes. What gives you hope?
I feel like the more people who I've seen be involved, Alex Brady and Renee Good were new to activism when they were doing their thing, they got killed, right? And I think when I've gone to protests, when I've done direct actions, and I've done direct actions in this act where people are like doing civil disobedience and risking arrest and being very disruptive, and then new people getting involved and new people wanting more all the time, that's what gets me.
I just, as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, was in Mississippi, went to the Mississippi Civil Rights Museum, and it just was soul-filling for me in a very specific way. It's like people faced unbelievably long odds, put themselves on the line, got arrested, got beaten, did that relentlessly, and they did it under conditions of profound uncertainty, no sense that tomorrow would be better than the past. And toppled racial authoritarianism in America. And it's just like, we have a tradition in this country of beating our own fascism, our own racial authoritarianism. And when you sit in a kind of temple to that, you feel like, oh yeah, we've been here before. We can do it again.
Yeah, no, with that, and also I teach, and my students, I'm at American University in Washington, D.C., and my students, they're coming, they want to make change, they are optimistic, cautiously, mostly, and I'm a cautious optimist, and I also think a lot of what we think we know will happen, the future is unpredictable, that could be good or bad,
But I tend to think my worry that Trump was going to build up an organization, one state party. Well, Viktor Orban's gone and Trump is not doing that. And
who saw Viktor Orban coming?
What?
16 years in power.
That's
very,
what you said.
Very strict authoritarian rule as well.
So it's just, I think a lot of times what we think will happen, we're not great at forecasting the future, but I think the next generation, I think the kids are all right.
What gives you hope?
I totally believe that we're going to win. And the reason I have hope is that I've decided that's how I want to live in the world, because you can search the evidence and search the landscape and find evidence for hope or despair. And so for me, the most personal act of resistance is that I'm drawing a line right here. And I'm not letting the white nationalists, the anti-democratic people into my spirit. I'm going to wake up every morning full of hope, ready to fight for my fellow people and the planet, and fuck them. I mean, there's just, it's a decision. I'm going to have hope, and they're not taking it away from me.
All right, there you go. And I guess on that note, will I answer my own question?
That was a good note to end on.
I thought it was a good way to end with her in the claps, man. You don't want to have me answer it. What gives me hope? You guys. I'll be honest. I came up here. I live in Mexico.
He wrote Freedom
Song. I don't live in the Bay Area anymore, and I drove, I think, 12, 13 hours.
Thank you for
it. To come here to talk to. I don't know who I'm going to talk to. It's not like they told me who was going to be here, who wasn't going to be here. But people give me hope. I moved to a country. I don't speak the language that well. And I'm always surprised at people. People always blow my mind. So, I don't know. I always have hope because I always come across interesting people that want to change the world. They may not look like the way I want to change the world. I listen to them. So I get to live in my little nook, my little weird cove in a weird part of Mexico that you people never go to. And I write about it. I write about stuff like this. I'm going to write about this meeting that I had in Berkeley with all these wacky people. Where'd the angry guy go that was yelling about Mondami? See, you made him so mad he left. Fucked up. No. Look, there's something to be said about having a fair deal of pessimism. And you heard my questions. I live in the dark, pessimistic underbelly. But every article I write, I have to end it with hope. Because if I don't end it with hope, then I suck. What's the point of writing it, right? So getting to meet Scott. Scott introducing me to Thomas, who, don't watch that episode. Please don't watch that episode. But I think there's hope to be had in these conversations, even in the arguing. Right. Even in these struggle sessions, the Maoist struggle sessions that we have in these rooms, there's hope to be had. But
first, I want to thank everybody who came out tonight. And I want to thank all the panelists who joined us. And I want to thank Jason Miles for moderating the panel.